Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. This year marks the centennial anniversary of a dark chapter in American history. In the summer of 1919, race riots and massacres spread to dozens of cities throughout the country in a series of events that would become known as Red Summer. Although hundreds were killed and entire communities destroyed, the stories of these events aren't featured prominently in our history books. Still, Reggie Jackson believes the legacy of these events can be found in the many civil rights victories that have happened in the century since Red Summer. Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum here in Milwaukee. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers and explains the cultural conditions in the United States before that summer.
World War I was ending. Many blacks had served in the war effort in Europe, had been treated pretty well over there, and came back and said, oh, well, we had fought for freedom and democracy, and we're going to demand that here. And people in the South did not particularly appreciate the fact that blacks came back very prideful. And there were a series of lynchings and major race riots around the country that summer. It actually started in April of that year and lasted all the way through November. You know, massive acts of anti-black violence around the country. And it was a very ugly period, and it's known by historians as Red Summer.
Yeah, it's called Red Summer. Of course, you know, you look at that time period in the United States, and lynchings had been going on for a while at that point, but this was really on another level. What was the initial event that kind of spurred the rest of this summer?
Well, you know, I don't think that there were necessarily any specific event. These were kind of things that were going on. There were instances of violent clashes between blacks and whites in major cities around the country. Issues in the South where blacks were still primarily living, where they were demanding equal treatment. They were demanding the right to vote again. So all those different things. But really kind of the first incident was in Georgia, in a small town in Georgia. A man ended up being murdered by a mob of whites because he had the audacity to write an article about a black person who had been lynched. Allegedly, he wrote the article, but no one really knows who wrote the article that was printed in the most prominent black newspaper, the Chicago Defender. So people in his town accused him of writing this article, you know, talking about whites who lynched this black person. And he refused to admit that he wrote the article. He said that he didn't. And they actually chased him down and eventually killed him. And that was in April of 1919. That was the first real kind of incident of what became Red Summer.
And it's something that, of course, spirals into a number of what seem to be called race riots. But the term riot seems a little misleading here in that a lot of these were just massacres. Mm-hmm. Where does the term riot, when does that start to kind of come in?
Well, you know, one of the things about it is we kind of have this perception of race riots in the country as the things that happened in the 1960s in Detroit and Newark and Milwaukee and place that nature, or after the Rodney King affair in 1992. But these were actually completely different. Blacks referred to them as riots in their newspapers because what generally happened in most of these incidents were some incident would spark some incident between blacks and whites in that community, and it would lead eventually to roaming mobs of armed whites, mostly men, but also women and children sometimes, leaving their community and going into black communities and beating people, looting their homes, looting their businesses, killing people, lynching people openly. So, you know, I tell people all the time that these are the race riots that you didn't hear about because the perpetrators were whites.
Well, and that's something that came up almost immediately when I started researching this. You know, I talked to a number of people just casually about, you know, my work, and they had never heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
They'd
mm-hmm.
never heard of the Red Summer of 1919. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of amazing how much it has been buried. Why do you think it's been buried in our collective history?
Well, I think the main reason it's been buried is because it's a very ugly time period in American history. It's one of those parts of our history that we prefer to ignore because it makes us look bad. When you kind of look into the details of how these things played out, you know, Red Summer was kind of it was kind of the culmination of many years of these types of events. So, you know, you go back to 1898 in Wilmington, North Carolina, there was a major race riot there, which was caused by whites who were upset that there were so many black elected officials. They actually had a coup d'etat where they actually removed all the black elected officials and any whites who supported them. And then you had a major race riot in Atlanta in 1906, a major one in Springfield, Ohio, 1908. 1917, East St. Louis, Illinois, there was another major one. So these were things that had been happening for a significant period of time. In that particular summer, I think primarily as a result of blacks coming back from the war and having obviously been trained and using firearms and saying we're gonna protect our communities better than we could before because we know how to use these guns. And, you know, there were several black GIs who were actually lynched in their uniforms when they came back from serving in World War I. And so when you kind of look at it, it's not a period of time that America is really proud of. And we have a very high tendency of covering up these parts of American history because they don't fit in with the narrative of America being this place with liberty and justice for all. They fly in the face of that. So we prefer to run away from these things, hide from it, cover it up, not talk about it. But, you know, it's part of, for African Americans in particular, it's part of our lived experience. These are things that we don't forget. We talk about these things all the time. We are intimately familiar with these events. But most people aren't because they didn't learn about it in school because it's not in the textbooks in our school systems.
Well, and you think to yourself, this is really something that crafted the views of people at that time period and a legacy that continues to shape our view of race relations in this country, whether we recognize that or not.
Yeah, absolutely. We tend to not really kind of now understand why race relations are so difficult. And I say primarily the reason is because we don't know American history very well. We have not been taught many of these things that would really help us understand why race relations are what they are today. And it goes back many, many years. And what's fascinating about the summer of 1919, obviously, we're celebrating, I guess, memorializing the 100th anniversary of that summer. We're also memorializing the 400th anniversary of the first Africans to arrive on slave ships in August of this year. So, you know, this is kind of an important year. But one of the things that I want people to kind of understand about Red Summer is the resilience of the black communities who were attacked and lost, you know, people. They did something that had very rarely been done in that way, and that was to fight back. And that fight that they had in them at that particular time was really, in many ways, the beginnings of the modern civil rights movement. Those things led to the NAACP becoming more involved in advocating for, you know, fair treatment of blacks. You began to have court cases challenging Jim Crow segregation. You began to see really a strong push for blacks to change the way that they were being treated, and particularly because they said, you know, we're fighting this war in Europe for freedom and justice there, but we're not receiving it here. We are going to demand it here, and that really began a push over a number of years for significant changes in America.
Well, and that comes up in maybe the most famous of these incidents in Elaine, Arkansas. So this was something that involved sharecroppers. For people who might not know what sharecropping is, mm-hmm. Can you explain that a bit?
So sharecropping was a system that developed after slavery ended. You still had these large farms in the South. You had blacks who living in these rural communities who couldn't find work for the most part. Some of them got work as what were known as sharecroppers. So there would be some land that had some crop on it, like cotton or some other crop, and they needed workers. They needed farmers. And so what they would do is white landowners would allow a black family to work the land for them and then supposedly give them a share of the profits from it. That's where the name comes from. But in most cases, the way it worked was that they would be given, you know, a place to live. They'd be, you know, allowed to use kind of the plantation store to buy food and clothing and things of that nature. But that would come out of the profits that they would get at the end. And what ends up happening generally for most sharecroppers at the end of this, and there were whites who were sharecroppers as well, is that by the end of the year, once you know harvest the crop and you do the books, you find out that you're in debt to that person. And so you have to start off the new year in debt. And it's kind of a continuing cycle perpetuated. And this system, sharecropping, lasted all the way through the 1970s before it finally kind of went away, primarily because of more mechanized farming and less need for that type of labor. But it was a system that was very corrupt. Blacks who challenged whites who were cheating them out of their money were in many cases lynched or run out of town. And it was a system that was the primary means of making ends meet for blacks throughout the South for a long period of time.
Well, and that's essentially what happens in Elaine. A number of these sharecroppers get together and they say, this isn't right, this isn't fair. Can you tell us a bit about what happened in Elaine?
Well, you know, any time there were instances of black individuals or groups who challenged the system of sharecropping or any system that minimize their aspiration for doing better, they would always be challenged. And so this group of black sharecroppers got together and said, wait a minute. Every year we're getting shorted money. We're getting cheated. And we don't think it's right. And we need to collectively challenge this. And so they put together a group to challenge the system. And the whites who owned the land did not appreciate it. They were very angry about it. And what ends up happening is one thing leads to another, and there ends up being this large group of white men who are armed who attack this group of sharecroppers for doing what really was the right thing to do to get some fairness out of the system. And it leads to very bloody couple days in Elaine, Arkansas. And in many respects, many of those blacks who were fighting ended up fleeing Elaine, Arkansas. Of course, they were blamed for the violence themselves, even though they didn't start it. And it was kind of the norm for how most of these riots took place was the black victims would be blamed in some way, shape, or form for their victimhood.
But unlike a lot of these riots, it does culminate in a case that goes to the Supreme Court. A number of them are, you know, given the death sentence for their participation, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. they appeal it and they appeal it, mm-hmm. and it creates this landmark case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, you know, one of the things, like I said earlier, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund started to get involved in these cases. And these men were challenging the system of sharecropping. They were challenging whether or not the system was fair, and then all of a sudden they're accused of violence and murder. And they knew that that wasn't the case. They were certainly not going to just accept that as being their station in life, being sent to prison for murder, and they challenged it. And it was one of those things that was very rarely done for blacks to have the ability to challenge these types of convictions and have it go all the way to U.S. Supreme Court. It was something that was exceptionally rare. And it set a precedent for other cases moving forward that we can do this. And it really, like I said, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund really played a huge role in this. They had been gathering together some of the best black attorneys in the country to make sure that blacks had the type of representation that they needed and that they could have success with. And so that was just one example of type of work that they did. And, you know, some of these same attorneys were involved in other cases around the country. Some of these same attorneys were some of the people who built the case to end Jim Crow segregation over a period of 20-plus years. So this is really one of those things that happened that show blacks that, you know, if we have the right resources available to us, then we can begin to make some gains and fight against some of these unjust systems in the South.
Well, and essentially, they found that the men on trial were not judged by a jury of their peers because their peers were not allowed to be in the jury.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, that was pretty typical in the South, is that you had all white juries. And so, you know, jury of your peers with no blacks on it. And there were a variety of reasons that blacks weren't on the juries. Many of them weren't allowed to vote, and so that was a requirement in some places. And in other places, it was simply like it didn't matter we simply were not going to allow a black person to testify against a white person in any criminal case. And that was a norm across the country. You know, we talk about the jury of our peers, but for the most part, even to this day, when you're sitting as a defendant in a court as a black person and you look at the jury is not going to look like you. It's a jury of your peers, but it really rarely looks anything like you. And so that was part of what they were challenging, is that the jury was rigged. And so we had no chance of possibly winning the case because it was pretty much set in stone because of who you had on the jury.
What do you think is the legacy of the Red Summer? Because, of course, we don't quite remember it in history perhaps the way we should, but it has impacted, as you've mentioned, it's impacted so much of our culture.
Well, I think that the impact in the black community in particular, this was a time where the Chicago Defender newspaper was a very popular paper. It started as a kind of a hometown paper, but they began to kind of spread news about blacks around the country in a way that hadn't been done before. They were actually outlawed in the South in most states. It was against the law to even be in possession of the Chicago Defender newspaper. You also had groups like the Urban League, which had started earlier, and NAACP. And so you began to see at that particular time a turning point for blacks. Just, you know, not even 20 years before that is a period that most historians refer to as the nadir, so the lowest point ever for blacks, even lower than, you know, the period of hundreds of years of enslavement, was a point where we'd been given these rights after the Civil War ended, you know, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. We had civil rights laws, all these different things. But then you begin to see a reversal of those things. And over a 20-year period of time leading up to World War I, blacks went from doing okay to being basically disenfranchised in every way possible. And this was the turning point to change the course of history for blacks, particularly in the South, because the Red Summer was so violent and it occurred in so many different places, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Lane, Arkansas, Ellisville, Mississippi, you know, Connecticut, all over the country these events happened, 27 major race riots around the country. Blacks paid quite a bit of attention to it, and one of the things they paid a lot of attention to was the fight, to not just allow people to come in and do these things, but to fight back. And that really built a mindset among blacks that, you know what, it's time that we take the fight to America and challenge it for what it stands for, because it doesn't stand for that for us. And it really, many of the greatest black intellectuals and leaders use that as a springboard to build capacity within the black community to have, you know, organizations that would fight for their rights, to have attorneys that would challenge things. It was really a really important point, and some historians refer to it, like I said, as the beginning of the modern civil rights movement. It didn't really start off as really that's what we wanted to do, but it was one of those things where, you know what, we can either sit back and continue to be victimized in this way, to have roaming mobs of whites kill men, women, and children, and burn and loot and burn property, or we can fight back. And, you know, even though that Red Summer was much publicized around the world in many respects, it didn't end these types of events. Probably the most famous race riot of this type was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just 2 years later in 1921, where hundreds of blacks were killed by mobs of whites. Their homes and businesses and churches were looted and burned to the ground. The largest black-owned hotel in the country was in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And literally 35 square blocks of Tulsa, Oklahoma was destroyed, the entire black section of Tulsa, which many people refer to as Black Wall Street because there was a prosperous business district there. So 2 years after the Red Summer, we thought we'd made some progress, but then we had the events in Tulsa. And it just kind of let black people know that we still have a long way to go. We found a way to publicize these things. We found a way to get this part of the national consciousness, but we still have a long, long way to go. And I think ultimately, as you kind of look back on it, and I still think that most people, even within the African-American community, don't know much about Red Summer, don't know the details of it, don't know how extensive it was. You know, when I was a teacher, I would assist our social studies teachers when they were talking about World War I. And I would tell them that you have to talk about Red Summer as well, because this is something that happened and that World War I played a role in it. And, you know, these were things that were shocking to many of the teachers that I work with. They weren't familiar with it. So I think the legacy would be much more than it is if people remembered it or knew about it or had learned about it. I think that the fact that this is the 100th anniversary of it obviously will, you know, make people more aware of it. But I still think that in general, people don't get it. They don't understand it. And as I've talked about these topics, you know, around the state of Wisconsin, traveling to, you know, very, very white communities and talk about the legacy of some of these things, lynchings and these race riots that I knew they didn't know about, they're quite surprised to hear it. And they're very disturbed by it. They're like, man, I wish I would have known that. I had no idea that those things were done. And I think as you raise people's awareness of it, Joy, what it does is it creates a sense of people saying, you know what, I need to learn more about this. I need to understand more about how this impacted life 100 years ago and why it's still important to this day.
Reggie Jackson is the head griot of America's Black Holocaust Museum, and he was recently featured on CNN's United Shades of America with W. Kamau Bell. Jackson spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers.